welcome to your last talk at Black Hat. I'm FX of Finlit, and since nobody ever believes that Finlit consists of more people than just FX, I just brought them here. So they're supposed to sit here and be nice and actually do the advertisement while we switch tapes and stuff. Okay, what we're talking about today is attacking networked embedded systems. In contrast to the stuff that Job just talked about, we're actually looking at embedded systems that are sitting on networks and are fairly widely used already, which you can't really say about XDAs and stuff. But so the session today is going to be about design failures, typical things where someone just didn't think, and we're talking about different design failures we saw in embedded systems, and then we're talking about how to exploit one of those. And then, of course, there are those software vulnerabilities, like someone didn't do something right, and, well, we're going to discuss some of those and see if we can exploit one. So what's an embedded system? For the purpose of this talk, an embedded system is a small computer device sitting in some box, or maybe actually sitting in a car or whatever. It usually runs a custom operating system, not like the Windows CE stuff, but more like monolithic code just built for this one single purpose the embedded system is fulfilling. Like, for routers, it is supposed to forward packets from A to B. For embedded systems like a BMW 7 Series, it's supposed to like tell you all kinds of stuff about your gas and whatever. So this is what we're looking at. We actually spent quite a while looking at different operating system kind of things that run little devices, because it's kind of interesting to see how much it didn't change in contrast to commonly used operating systems. Now, one thing is that those cannot be updated easily. If you got a bug in your 7 Series BMW computer system, there is not something like a link you click and download a patch and install it. You can't even go and take a CD and put it in and say, patch BMW. You actually have to go to your dealer and ask him to update the embedded device in your car. Actually, the bad thing is that those dealers usually don't even know what a computer is. So you might actually have a hard time patching this specific embedded systems, and it's actually true for most of them. And of course, we have no or very, very limited ability to add third-party software. So if the system itself sucks badly, like with Windows, you go and buy all kinds of tools, install them on Windows, so it sucks a little bit less. Well, with embedded systems, you can't do that. That's one of the core problems. Now, design failures are very, very common in embedded systems. And this is not a classification, but it's like the three most common things we see. First of all, undocumented functionality, stuff that is basically not supposed to be there. And it's often something like developer backdoors, because, well, if you start coding this thing, you get a board with the chipset, with the chip layout. You can install your software, try it out, burn some elements out of it, fix it, try it again. As soon as you decide as a developer, okay, let's call it beta, you install it on the real box. And then, if something goes wrong, you need a way to get back in and fix it. So we often have developer backdoors. And then we have something I call outer something functions. Now take the case of Joey, I don't know, IP, going and buy an ISDN router. So Joey takes the ISDN router out of the box, plugs it in. Hopefully he does not plug ISDN in the Ethernet port, but, well, assume he didn't blow the device up 5 minutes after you took it out of the box. He's gonna get a CD, put the CD in the computer, and basically say, well, install device. Now, Joey doesn't know anything about IP. And the vendors try to solve that by having outer something features. So this little program on the CD, besides having fancy pictures and stuff, is going to use some very special method to find a device that's not configured and going to configure it. Now, the problem is that those configuration options are often still accessible and even remotely accessible while the device is already configured and working. Well, then we got problems with ignored standards, which is kind of very common. One type of embedded system we're especially interested in is Cisco routers, and they got this habit of there is an RC for protocol, and then you go to the Cisco web page, and if you find something on the Cisco web page, it will say Cisco's interpretation of this protocol. So it's kind of like a little bit different always, and those are always the pitfalls. And well, of course, undocumented, uncontrolled increase in complexity is very, very critical. We all know that if you've got marketing people in your company you're working for, you know how that works. They convince us and tell you, well, we need the VRML interface for your little print server by tomorrow close of business. So please go ahead and code a 3D interface to a print server. Now, nobody is going to complain about that anymore because it's standard, but there is no time to think about what are the possible influences on all the other things we implemented the same way the 3 weeks before. So there might be actually like cross-referencing things that don't work out. Now, the first case, the loosened brick is a firewall. It's a layer 2 firewall. It runs an operating system with the very interesting name of Inferno. And it's a custom-built operating system written by the Bell Labs guys. It's actually pretty good. And so this firewall is a layer 2 firewall. So it's supposed to just bridge the traffic through and, well, drop packets that are evil according to the configuration. Now the problem here is that the operating system wasn't designed in the first place to be a firewall operating system, so the whole op handling stuff is not very fitting for a firewall, which means it passes out on always, no matter what the configuration says. If you say drop everything and you send an op request through the firewall, you get op reply. Fine. So you can basically op scan the whole network through the firewall from the outside. And there are more issues with that, especially from the outside or from any given interface. IP address is there. So what you actually run MAC addresses and known IP addresses and pings. Now, it's really bad for this thing here, which is called the LSMS management server. That's the one where you click together your rules and then you see the logs on. So basically what you do is send an op reply with the LSMS IP and disable logging and configuration for the And another thing was that they decided to save performance to have the op cache not time out. Well, it's actually a good idea if you want to have performance because, well, you don't have to re-ask for the same MAC address over and over again. The bad thing is, what happens if you get lots of op replies? Well, guess what happens? It basically crashes and pukes all over you. Second case, design failures. SSN routers. This is one of those outer something features that really kicked in about 10 years later. The way SSN solved that for small devices is having a UDP packet with the magic header, it's basically like 8 bytes, magic number, whatever, sent to the discard port. Now, normally the discard port would basically do what the name suggests, discard the packet. This one is going to fill it with all the critical information, like listed here, and send it back to you. And so to enable the SSN tool to actually make it configure IP addresses and stuff, and there's also a way in the same protocol over the discard port to set the SNMP community, put the SNMP write community in the packet, put a new IP address in, put a new name in and the NAT mask, send it over, and the device will reconfigure itself. Okay, problem here is they coded that into Tails, which is their operating system for everyone who has seen SN routers. It's the one with the menus, with the ASCII menus. Now, the same operating system is used in fairly big dial-in routers as like handling multiple T1 connections. And they still do this protocol. So you set up your big dial-in router, being an ISP or whatever, and well, for security, and since you heard about the Protoss test suite for SNMP and stuff, you basically disable SNMP, which leads you to the assumption that you do not need to change the default SNMP write community. Well, then someone can send a maybe spoofed UDP packet to your router, give it a new name, a new IP address, and a new net mask, which is fairly bad. Another thing Essent came up with, and this time they did it totally differently, is they had an idea, and instead of straight away implementing it, they wrote an RFC on it. It's called ATMP, has nothing to do with UTMP, and is the Essent Tunnel Management Protocol. The idea is to have dynamically created GUI tunnels between SN devices so that the user behind the SN device, the guy over here, can actually use the network he's dialing in the same way as he would be when he is connected locally. So basically what it does is enable your Windows network environment browsing. Well, the concept, as you see, is fairly complicated. You got several boxes here. Actually, on the corporate LAN, it's required to have a radio server and stuff like that. So you need quite a lot of devices. Unfortunately, they kind of like broke the whole concept because every SN router talks this protocol, even if they don't have a radio server, even if they are a small dial-in device, whatever, it talks this protocol. So you send in a request for creating such a GUI tunnel thingy, and it's supposed by RFC, which is written by SN, to go out and talk to the radio server and find out if you're supposed to have a tunnel. Since it doesn't have a radio server, it checks the local connection profiles. Now those profiles are not completely used, so you usually have one for dial-out and one for dial-in or whatever, and you've got like 30 profiles in the list. So you send the packet and you don't name the connection, so you don't give it like a username or whatever that would be used for authentication. And well, it goes ahead, tests the profiles, has an empty profile with of course an empty name, and goes like empty, that matches, cool. Sends you back a query, actually a challenge, for password authentication. Well, you just encrypt the challenge and send it back. It goes like, okay, empty password matches, here's your GUI tunnel. Brilliant idea. So what can you do with that? You basically talk ATMP to any given SN router that got this stuff enabled, which is by default, and well, you get a GUI tunnel ID back, so you can basically go to your Cisco or whatever you use for GUI and give it a tunnel ID, send it over, got the GUI tunnel right into the corporate network, and well, of course, the rest is game over. Next design failure, Cisco Enhanced IGFP. Well, Enhanced IGFP is a Cisco routing protocol, as most of you probably know, and it uses automatic neighbor discovery. We start asking the question, what's the maximum number of neighbors? Well, you start flooding the device with neighbors. It doesn't really behave bad, so it doesn't crash and stuff. But it got a problem here with, again, the op cache. Usually at Cisco, being a networking company, actually knows how to code op and stuff. So what they do is they op three times and then timeout. Well, didn't find the host. Now, with this routing protocol, the hello message you send to it is valid for a certain amount of time, which you provide in the packet. Now every time their timer for seconds actually goes one down, they figure, oops, we still need to talk to this guy, so we are up again. So now you send this default hello packet over with a non-existing IP, so it will actually 90 times up for you because the timer is, say, 30 seconds. If you send more than one, it will opt for all of them. So basically, the Cisco will use every possible CPU second it has and every possible piece of bandwidth it has connected to itself, opting for this device, which is a very efficient way to have a network-wide denial-of-service attack. The really bad thing about this is that the timer value you're providing is 16 bits, so the maximum is about 18 hours. Okay. That's another problem I got with this whole idea, because all iOS versions are affected, but, well, Cisco did not decide to fix it because it's probably too complicated. And so I'm not selling this device yet, but if there is huge demand for it, we're going to build those and sell them. Okay, let's explore the design failure. I think I'm way behind time. Yes, I am. HP printers. There's a lot of fun you can have with printers, and here's why. They got various access methods. You can go to the printer. Telnet, HTTP, FTP, SNMP, and something called PGL. Now, you can protect the printer. For Telnet and HTTP, you can set an admin password. You can have IP-based access restrictions based on a source IP. You can have a PGL security password. Well, but those things are inconsistent. As you see, HTTP, for example, is not protected by the IP access restrictions. Same holds true for SNMP. Now, HP has the habit of putting undocumented MIP variables in their MIPs that will basically return the password if you query them. So we got a variable here. The server of those depends on the firmware of the printer. And, well, you SNMP read this variable and get the admin password back, which you can instantly use to browse to a printer, enter the password, and basically you just owned a printer. Now, there is a way more convenient and effective way to do the same thing. PGL. PGL, the printer job language, is the stuff that runs basically the whole printing process. If you got networked HP printers and you got an HP driver, this is what the HP driver talks to the printer to set up your print job, legal size paper, Cicron, DPE, whatever. This whole thing relies on either non-password, which is in 110% the case, or between 1 and 65, 535. Well, this basically takes about 6 hours remotely brute forcing because there's also no lockout. And, well, now we're gonna look at what you can do with PGL on the printer besides printing. PGL allows you to access the printer's file system. And I have a file system. The printer has RAM and has flash. And those file systems in the early models are actually used to spool the jobs. Because if you send over the job, it's supposed to spool it and then print it out. Well, it has to store it some way, so they got a file system on it. It also contains PCL macros. Very common way to save your printing cost and not go to a printer shop, have your letterhead printed on paper and then put it in the printer. But instead of that, you go and put a PCL macro in your printer and say, well, every time you print something, put this letterhead on it. Good idea. Now we got access to this, so we can actually change information in the company's letterhead, which probably would be the bank account number. Well, all nice and funny, but actually the later models got more file system content. Web server with the web server content in firmware, which was not available in the earlier models to download. And, well, they got subsystem configuration. Now you can basically think of your printer as a PGL-based file server. And since print shops tend to be very large, you at least got about 8 megabytes of storage or whatever. But, well, there are printers out there, such as the, what's that, Tektronix kind of thing, that basically got about 80 gigabytes. Well, you can store a lot of stuff on that. This is how a file system actually on an HP printer looks like. You see there's a lot of stuff in here that's very interesting, and we're gonna discuss how to use that. Because PGL itself is an escape sequence based protocol or language, so it's very inconvenient to use over Netcat, and we started, well, being bored by copy and pasting stuff into Netcat, so we actually wrote a library doing this and developed a front end for command line, which basically gives you the ability to read environment variables of the printers, modify them, write them back, have full file system access, change display messages, and remove the PGL security. Now, what can you do with those features? First of all, let's take the least technical challenging but the most funny, changing display messages. You can set the display message that's shown when the printer is ready and idle to something like I'm bored. Very interesting, but you can actually send a display message and mark it as a critical failure. So the printer will go offline, the red light's flashing, and might actually say something like insert coin, which really confuses people. There's another thing with the environment variables in the same context. There is an environment variable called cplock. It is for locking the front panel. So while it flashes insert coin, you can actually set cplock to maximum, so no button on the front panel will ever work again. This is, well, of course, you can be really evil and set environment variables for a number of copies, set it to hard 999, and it will print 999 copies of everything. But yeah, you don't want to like destroy the few woods we still have out there. Actually, this guy over on the wall, wave to the crowd, please. Actually went ahead and wrote a Windows version for it. CSEs can actually start hacking printers. This is how it looks like. Notice the logo is no copyright violation. File system, environment variables, display. And well, this is how you access your printer now. You got a browser-like interface, and well, of course, you got those environment variables that will tell you what valid input is. You're not required to send valid input, and you can basically start playing with your printer. From the fun part to the scary part, later versions of HP printers run something that's called the ShyVM. The ShyVM is a Java virtual machine for embedded systems. This is where it's officially supported 9000 and those 4 series printers here. The 8150 runs it as well, and actually we found out that being unsupported, it's the most stable platform. The ShyVM comes completely with all the stuff you need. Classes, the HTML files for the printer, the graphics for the web server, whatever is required. So by just exchanging those HTML files and the graphics and stuff, you can basically build whatever you want on the web server of the printer. Now you can actually try it out as you can run a porn site of a printer. It all lives in a file system, and we have seen Eddie. So of course the next thing we're thinking about is like putting stuff in the file system that's going to be executed. Well, this thing here is from the HP Web is Cool, and it's used all over the place, not only in printers. Unfortunately, that's true. We are bound to see more HP stuff. ShyVM comes with something that's called the loader service. In case HP wants to improve whatever is on a printer with services. Now, this loader has two issues for us. First of all, it validates jar signatures. When you upload a jar, it has to be signed by HP. Now, the second thing turned out to be a good message. because HP went ahead and said, well, this one sucks, let's write something that does not suck that badly. And this one is shipped as a signed jar, but itself does not update if the uploaded jar is signed. Good for us. Now we can basically upload code. But instead of using the web browser clicky-clicky kind of way, we can actually modify the settings and have it load different Java classes and execute the stuff. Now the last point here says all the classes and documents. HP claims that there is no connection between DEFCON 10 and this decision, but, well, the stuff is no longer online. Luckily, they released the whole scheiß right before they closed the web page, which really, well, didn't make sense, but there are still lots of locations in the internet where you can download it, so if you want to. Yeah, this is basically the same thing. You can upload Easy Loader to, via the web interface, have it start, upload your jar file, or upload your class files and modify csconfig. Same thing. Well, problem here is, ShyVM isn't really Apache group code, which means that next to everything besides moving the mouse kills it. Too many threads, ShyVM kills. You connect to an unreachable host port on some firmware versions, it will die. It doesn't always throw an exception, which is fairly bad for Java, because Java kind of like requires exceptions to find out if something. And if you run PC, it will behave. If you want to play with the stuff, this SNMP variable here, reset the printer. What can you do with that? Well, the first thing we thought was it would be kind of neat if the printer would actually start port scanning web servers. For IDS administrators, it's a nightmare. Port scanner, where you can enter the IP and the number of ports, and if there's the right firmware on it, you can basically have the printer port scan the web server or whatever you like. By the way, IDS correlation tools, first of all, will throw out all messages that are sourced off printers, because that can't happen. I thought that's very interesting to do as very first thing in the correlation process. Then we figured, well, you got a password that's encrypted, and you don't want to burn your laptop CPU power, but the printer actually got MIPS CPUs, which are fairly fast, and so we wrote a web-based crack tool for it, where you can copy and paste your crypt string in there, and tell it the character set to brute force, and it's going to do the word, and then put the character, put the password on a web page, and you can, like 2 days later, serve to the printer and inspect it or not. And then, well, based on this whole IDS thing, lately, we're on TCP proxy, so you can basically tell it, let's see, we've got screenshots here, yeah. You can basically tell it the remote system at the remote port and the local printer port and like ton of to access IRC. Things HP came up with for the ShyVM. Well, ShyService, first of all, the same thing as Job was talking about in the phones, is true here. If the code runs on a printer, it can do whatever it wants. The service services offered by HP, I'm not entirely sure how many of those are still available. Just to mention two of those, the notifier service can notify you by HTTP or email if an interesting event happened. Now, an interesting event is defined by yourself. So I would, for example, define the CEO printing 6 in the evening as an interesting event and would really like to have this print job. The other service that really made us thinking is the Shine Mail service, which is, quote, designed to work across firewalls, unquote. No, there is no new protocol, there is no magic. What it does is it has an IP, it has an email account somewhere outside, let's say Hotmail, and it's constantly popping off mail from Hotmail and seeing if there is some command in there. So if there is, it will execute the command and send you a reply. Fairly nice. So you don't have to touch the printer anymore, you basically send them an email. So So if you want to screw around in companies, usually the days after blackheads are fairly bad for companies that have lots of printers. This is where you get the tools and, well, communicate with your people over the display. And we go on to something a bit more serious, which is software vulnerabilities. Classic mistakes are also made in embedded systems. Embedded system developers are not any smarter than those writing Windows code or whatever. They just got smaller devices. So they do the same things. Input validation, faults, format screen, buffer overflow, cross-site scripting, you name it. The second point here, most HTTP daemons are vulnerable. Correction all. I have to see one single HTTP daemon on an embedded device that's not totally toast. Example, yesterday you might actually have noticed that the internet connection here went down for a while. Well, they got three different DSL routers, three different brands, three different web servers. I tested one single vulnerability. They're all toast. They all crashed. It was like the first try, three different devices, three different web servers, same issue. By the way, if you wonder what it was a long username. So it seems like the fact that there are limited resources, and it's, well, like, it's a black box, nobody is going to do anything with it. They just don't check stuff, length checks, functionality, input validation, whatever. Now, other buffer overflows besides hotel DSL routers. Xedao routers, now actually losing product, fairly good router, got a web server, long URL, get request, toast is the router. Router network printers, you don't even need to send a long get request or whatever, you just serve to the printer, it asks you for a password, you hold the A key for a while, click on submit, the printer is gone. HP Procurve switch, fairly funny thing because usually if you got SNMP right, it doesn't matter, you just own the thing and you can modify everything. But this vulnerability here is very handy for attackers because you go there, you fill this OID here with 85 characters and nothing happens. The switch works perfectly. Now, as soon as the administrator has the idea of telnetting to the switch or using the web interface, the switch will crash. Which is very good if you're in a network and you're the evil guy. You fill it up, you start hacking around, and as soon as the switch crashes, you know someone is looking for you. And even stuff like really small things, the SEH IC9 is a pocket print server, size of a cigarette pack. For all the non-smokers, this is how a cigarette pack looks like. And this one, same thing. You have a long get request, it will crash. Which is very bad for the printers actually, because if it's connected to a laser printer, for example, the laser printer really dislikes being resetted over the Centronics connection while printing something. So you can basically destroy the printer with it. This is how the whole device looks like. Nobody's gonna consider this something that might be for attackers. But, well, you can actually turn it into an attack platform if you want. Now, common misconceptions here. Embedded systems are harder to exploit. Sure, you don't have a debugger, you don't have the classic concept of a shell, so what are you going to do? You have to reverse engineer the whole thing because, well, there is no public, you sometimes don't even know what CPU it's running on. You have to do that to meet all the syscalls, library calls, stuff like that to actually make something happen. The worst thing that will happen is, well, the device crashes, reboots, whatsoever. I don't think so. Let's see. Cisco IOS is and preferred playgrounds. And it's also a perfect example for an embedded system OS because it's a huge chunk of code, it doesn't have any API, and it got lots of bugs. Let's see if we can exploit an overflow condition in IOS. It's tightly integrated. Well, maybe corruption. Yeah. Oh, in fact, one thing is a heap of free long file from the Cisco TFTP that base and actually lead in DNS, like on the console. Actually notice, although really delicious. On Cisco system, most other box linked together structure actually And one of those boxes, and this is that you allocate one byte, every 100 byte, you need a new 40 bytes. The project that's actually, how's it called? In the size field, we got another 32, which is fucked it up. Or the idea here, hosted, overwrite the memory management suite with Linux and Windows. That's the pointer exchanges, even on commonly used, are based off exploitation up on free. Is we got this double linked list. He has to take one of those blocks out of the used list, so it actually steps over the block. So pointer exchange takes place. Interesting enough, this is done. The IME heap overflow is kind of funny when they wrote starts up linked list to find this one checks static value, ignores the next pointer size and usage, and these are the messages that's here. So since this stuff flow up to here is block, so we take the first target 2500. Here we overflow the whole thing, put some R here is actually the red zone to close the first block, and then we can put stuff in here, and this down here is the memory address of the NVRAM. Anyone has an idea why NVRAM is kind of important here? Anyone? Yeah, this is where the config lives. Now the config contains the passwords, right? And after all, we want to attack the router and actually take it over. So by sending this, it will perform the pointer exchange. And since on the 2500, every process is allowed to write in the NVRAM, it will take the other pointer, the previous pointer, and actually write it right into the NVRAM. Now the question is, what's so cool about writing unpredictable crap into the NVRAM? So cool about this is, the NVRAM is checksummed. So as soon as the device figures out, something wrong, memory is totally toast, I just wrote right into the NVRAM, I'm going to reboot. It's going to do that, reboot, check if there is a config, load the config, calculate the checksum, figure out the checksum doesn't match, so I'm not running this config. But to be not a useless piece of junk sitting somewhere and crying for help, it's actually crying for help on the network. Basically what we do is we send the exploit, it will reboot, and then it will cry out on the network code, someone please provide a configuration for me, which we will happily do. But besides being very easy, we have to be local, and we have to provide the config on the local network, and it has to be a 2500. And we actually want to do this remotely. So we have to get around those requirements. The first thing is the previous pointer here. As I said, this one is checked. So the previous pointer is checked by this fairly effective test here. So there's only one single solution for it. I didn't find a good way to predict it. So I actually took the way by killing the device first, flow just a bunch of A's. And then it comes to how the memory layout looks like, because every time it boots, it will do the same things in the same serial matter. And so we actually know some addresses, and we can use those in a second level flow, writing this new block header. What we want to do here, when we actually build the whole block header and step over the previous pointer, is this is the stuff we just discussed, and then for a free memory block, there's even more header information, just in case you have enough memory. There is 4 bytes padding, another magic, another code address, more padding, and then we've got a free next and a free previous pointer. Those pointers are used in another double linked list for free blocks. So, those pointers are especially important when blocks are merged together. You get two small memory blocks just freed, and IIS figures out, they're next to each other, so I make one big block out of it. And luckily, those pointers are not checked at all. Nobody cares about them. So now we get the perfect place for arbitrary memory write by providing those two pointers here. this is the point where exchange taking place, very predictable. And, well, we also got the size field. As I said, the size field is checked, but it is checked with a 32-bit variable. So as soon as they calculate something, they will shift data next and forth, and by providing this number here, they will actually have a 100% int overflow and end up at the same place after adding stuff that they started from. So it's always valid because it points to the same thing. And well, that's easy. So we can overflow up to the previous pointer and have an arbitrary memory write. Now what to do with an arbitrary memory write? We could say, idiot, and write it to the console. That the more effective thing to do here is find places in code that will be used as return addresses. There is a thing called a process array. That's basically an array of all processes ordered by PIT, and those, in turn, every entry in this array points to a huge chunk of memory that contains everything you wanted to know about the process and a lot of stuff you didn't want to know. But the first two fields of this block are actually the stack pointer and the stack segment address. Now, we actually know where the stack is. And since this is an embedded system and a huge chunk of code, there is no protection against one process writing in someone else's area. So we basically can write into the stack, into the process array, into the process information record, into whatever we want. So we can overwrite friend pointers, return addresses, all the juicy stuff we know from textbook exploitation. The next thing is, okay, we can take the processor, overwriting pointers, and see, and actually make it execute our code, but how do we deliver the code? Because the problem here is that on iOS, if you send something and it's freed, it's actually overwritten. It's actually deleted by OD. I assume that they actually got really problems in an earlier version of iOS using blocks that were already free, so they decided to really delete the memory. But since the fake header we are building uses the free header information for a free block for the pointer exchange, it's already considered free. We can append the code at this point and have it execute this code. Shellcode, or however you call it, code for the print, will be platform dependent, which is a bad thing. You have to write new code for every different platform because Cisco tends to maintain a zoo of CPUs. The Sphere is based on a Cisco 1600. It got a 68K CPU. And, well, this one has memory registers. So since we are not allowed to directly write into the NVRAM, we have to write a piece of code that's going to disable the protection for the NVRAM and then write crap to it. This is the piece of code. Basically, well, it's textbook exploitation. Instead of opening a remote root shell, we're just disabling NVRAM at, well, the address was just on the other slide here. At this address, there is a register, so all you have to do is like get this data into the pointer and shift it, and so get rid of the register. And then you can, of course, write, that's the last line, some root shit into the NVRAM, and we have the same effect as before. The next thing is, that's the old one. Right, and this is how it looks like. We have the device crashing with battery, booting up, we cut up the legal stuff out here, asking for network configuration. Network configuration contains the information how the config is supposed to be called, and then it goes downloading the config from our TFTP host and being happy. We still have to be local, which still sucks. So let's do the same thing remote. Instead of invalidating the NVRAM, we just go ahead and first of all disable interrupts because it's an interrupt-driven system and we don't want to have iOS interrupt. Unprotect the NVRAM so we can write there. take a new configuration, calculate the length field and all this header crap, which calculate the checksum for it, and write it into the NVLAN chip directly, no support of iOS needed. Then we, just to be nicer, and get a new configuration up and running. This is how that looks like. It got the overflow, it got the fake block, then it got, before we got this issue with null characters and all the crap, so what we're doing is have a bootstrap code that will self-modify the rest of the code, XOR, typical thing, and well, this XOR code is then taking the appended configuration and write it into the NVRAM and reboot the device. This is how that looks like. Notice there is no more crying around for a crash because we cleanly rebooted, which has the nice side effect that even on router forensics, it will say the device is rebooted by a reload command, and nothing except for the new configuration indicates that someone played with it. You see that it boots up, finds a new interface because the configuration didn't mention it. And, well, of course, you provided the configuration, so you can turn it to your newly configured docu router, enable yourself, and then play around. This is how one of those fake blocks we're building looks like. It looks scarier than it is. Actually, it's just the stuff we already discussed here. And then we got, this is the self-modification code that basically decodes the rest of the config code. I think I have time for the second one. Where do I, Keith? You're supposed to end? Okay, we can make that. It's very interesting, actually. EF, as the name suggests, is an oops in OSPF. In contrast to the enhanced IGRP thing we discussed in the design failures, Cisco routers actually have. It looks like the guy who wrote it, or one of the guys who wrote it, they expected more than 255 neighbors. So he was living in class C network world. Now, you got a network that's a little bit bigger, you have the strong possibility of having more than 255 neighbors. At least we did so. This one builds a table and copies the table to a piece of memory to do whatever it does with those tables, to an allocated memory block, which is too small. So, the big difference here is, one, it is a different kind of memory, because iOS, of course, has more than one type of memory. Second, it's not one single packet thing. And third, we are in a totally different position in terms of memory layout. Exploitability, as I said, it builds a table. This table consists of the router ID in the OSPF hello packet, which has one big advantage. It allows null characters. And the second big advantage is it's not checked. You can put whatever you want in there as a router ID. The only thing you have to fulfill is have the IP source, the source IP for the OSPF hello come from the right network, which is not too complicated to do nowadays. Well, here's the memory thing. We got I.O. memory in Cisco routers. They decide, they memory, which on so-called shared memory routers, like the small ones, isn't really important. Since, well, the name suggests shared memory, they share the memory, it's all the same. But on the bigger island, it's actually physically totally different and is used for fast forwarding stuff. And so this design, this memory design is totally different than the classic we allocate something and keep it and free it later. It's fixed size blocks. You can actually change those, but it's a number of fixed size blocks. It's like a t-shirt store. You got like a small, medium, large, extra large tent. And well, this is all used for effective forwarding. So when a packet comes in, you're not supposed to allocate memory. Look, if the memory is actually, yeah, you got memory, copy the packet in there, move move it over to another interface, send it out, but you have fixed size buffers on the size of the MTU, for example, for private buffers, and you get like the packet in, packet out. Go. Now what we do with the OOPSPDF exploit is basically send in all the router IDs, and for those of you who know those surprise things, like little surprise X, it's pretty much like a Überraschungsei exploit, which is a German joke, sorry. didn't work here. Anyway, it's pretty much like, hey Cisco, take this, piece it together for us, and, well, use it for something. Packets, the table builds up. At some point in time, it overflows the block header, as we see here, this time from bottom to top. So, 56 IP addresses, we got a fairly large buffer, well, 1K. And with overriding the block header here, we got the same situation. We are not at the end of... And as I said, those blocks are not frequently allocated and freed, but they're kept static. The only difference is they have thresholds for, I need more blocks, well, then it's going to increase the number of blocks, obviously allocate memory, and depending on those thresholds, it's going to do that for a while and then stop and then free them again to go to the permanent level and whatever. And so we're in the middle of it. And we have to use memory management tricks to convince it to do something. Well, most of you actually know that with them, you sometimes have to like bullshit it to make it do something. So it's the same here with memory. This is how the IRS sees it. It has fixed and moves stuff in and out all the time without traversing down the linked list because that would be too slow. And for the memory manager, it's a linked list. So what we basically do is we're the last block. Please do something with me. And, well, IRS still works correctly. Now this is how it looks like if you do it, and you show the IO memory, you see in the last line here, or probably there in the books, that the what field strongly indicates this is not a Cisco memory allocation taking place here. And the nice thing about that is you do the overflow and the router stays stable. Because it still has all the addresses and still uses the memory and copies stuff in and out, it doesn't use the linked list, so the router is still stable. Now you can go ahead and exceed the threshold by blowing all kinds of traffic through the router. It's going to be, ooh, Lord, need more buffers, allocate buffers, buffers. Then you stop sending, then he's got like lots of buffers. Checks, okay, it says I'm supposed to like free those buffers and go back to normal permanent level. As soon as it frees it, it executes your code. So you got a dormant exploit, and next time you do a flop ping, it's going to be an active exploit. Yeah, this is what I just said. Heavy traffic, complex routing updates. You can also call the guy and say, look, there's this evil Cisco worm out there. You have the console and say, buffer is small, permanent zero. And then he's actually executing your code, which might actually be an evil Cisco one. A minimum IRS config, because normally in those packets you don't have too much space, but this is the minimum IRS config one should use, with an IP address for one interface and a route back to you. Don't forget that part. And this is how it looks like on a 2500 with OOPSPDF. It boots up, as you see. Finds new interfaces, all surprised about it, and you can take it over. Now this is the work to do. The stuff I'm talking about here is not a teaser SSH exploit. It's more like in the lab stuff, not for field use. So one could argue that you can't really, well, it's not really a danger. So work to do is actually to get rid of all the guesswork, like the previous pointer, and produce fairly stable exploits, and of course have the code do different things, like runtime modification of the binary, runtime modification of the config, anti-forensics code that stores in any stuff like, well, not the crash information, but something different. Would suggest maybe a song text or whatever to entertain. IS exploits are what? Well, those are not stable exploits, as I said, so what's the big deal here? The whole stuff is vulnerable to the edge. Like your network interface and a little bit of RAM is vulnerable. And at some point in time, some sick German guy is going to write an exploit for it and make it his next attack platform. And, well, it also, those devices contain important information, SNMP communities, network layout, radio secrets, everything. How to protect? Well, first of all, do not rely on one type of device. If everything in your shop says Cisco on it, you're toast. Everything in your shop says Checkpoint on it, you're toast. Different story. Consider all your network equipment vulnerable. As I said, there is not one single HTTP daemon that is how the protocol implementations are. Do not ignore stuff just because it's small. Such a small print server got enough CPU power and enough RAM to outsmart a bunch of things that used to fly to the moon 20 years ago. So it certainly has the capability technically to run all kinds of evil code. And well, plan your device management as you plan root lock-ins on Linux boxes. If you tell it to your Cisco routers, nobody needs an exploit. How to protect your HP printer? Set an admin password. Tend it to the printer. You will see it doesn't ask for a password. First thing, set an admin password. Set SNMP read and write communities. And pray that you don't have one of those firmwares that have a hard-coded SNMP read-write community. You can use PGF protection, but as I said, it's easy to brute force, so you might actually just buy yourself a little bit of time. Remove the default loader from the csconfig file. Well, if there is no loader, someone has to actually use the PFT tool or the hijacker tool to upload code. Well, and consider putting the printers behind the IP filter device, or if it's important and only the CEO prints on it, there are still things you can buy at shops that are called LPT cables. Just because the printer has a network interface, you're not forced to use it. If it's critical, just plug it into the backside of the CEO's PC. Nobody's going to hack that part. Well, the first point, I could not resist putting that in. If you know some people at Cisco, get the word out, stop copying stuff in buffers that are not big enough for it. That will save them a lot of trouble. And keep your IOS up to date is also more like a joke, because if you're running Cisco on a large scale, you actually know that if you install the latest iOS, you got bleeding edge. And it's probably more effective denial of service to have the latest iOS than any given FinoNet member in your network. Do not run unneeded services. This is the oldest message since passwords were invented. Do not run TFTP if you don't use it. The IDS signature here is a little bit problematic, because this NorthBest actually told me at CanSec that it was fairly dangerous to put it in your IDS. I didn't know that, because MPEG videos use exactly this byte sequence for framing. And so some of the Snort guys tried it and actually had a denial of service on the Snort, because when users downloaded MPEG streams, the Snort was crying all over the place that, well, the Ciscos are under attack. But it works if you're limited to the Cisco device IPs, because if Cisco starts downloading MPEG streams, it's too late. Debug sanity is an undocumented command on iOS. It should actually be renamed to debug insanity, because it basically kicks off check heaps more often and has more restrictive tests. But with all the exploits we've read so far, it always catched us after we did it, so that just lowered the time you got for code execution, but that's not a problem. The hard way is config register 0, which tells the device next time you boot up, stop and run one, instead of loading anything. So we can't reboot, and the device hangs in like the BIOS. The thing about this is, you have to tell everybody in your company about this. Otherwise, someone is going to reload the box, and then you get out the car keys and a map and tell them where the router is located, give him a console cable, and send him on his way.
Is this
in
NVRAP, so that you can actually change it?
Yeah. Well, wait a minute. The config register is in NVRAM, although specific, that's only for the shared memory routers as far as I know. I think there are actually other protected areas in the bigger ones. But for the smaller ones, it actually would perform logging on a separate segment, because if someone is seeing your syslog message, it's going by with all the addresses where the stuff crashed, it's way easier to your syslog host. That's the last slide. Greets to all those people, especially Jeff and Ping, just coming in here. Thanks to you for listening and not running away before the conference closed. And, well, I'm open for questions. That's what I thought.